Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I have a great conversation with Rebecca Herbst. She and her husband, Joe, had a fairly quick journey to get to FI, only like 4 to 5 years. And we talk about it briefly. We only spend a small amount of time on that topic. And we really spend a lot of time on some post-FI ideas. One interesting thing that Rebecca and Joe did was try to find a city to move to. And like many people, when they retire early, things are a little bit different than they expected. So we go through some of the details of how they were, you know, looking at different cities and the process they went through. One cool thing, we spend a long portion of this talking about Longmont because I actually stopped by Longmont to check it out a couple summers ago. I don't remember exactly when it was, but they did swing by for a little while. Eventually decided to go somewhere else. I don't want to spoil too much. But again, we spend a lot of time on post-FI topics. And another one is identity that's tied to your career and something that Rebecca needed to work on in a dedicated way. And it sounded like it took some time, and I've hung out with her a couple times and she seems pretty chill. So I think maybe, you know, it worked. Whatever she was working on, it went really well. So great conversation here. And one note, I don't tell people about this often enough. I'll just mention it. If you like this podcast and you want to support it, you could head over to Buy Me a Coffee, and there's a link in the description. I want to keep the show ad-free. I'm not going to make this a long ad or spend too much time on it, but basically you get a little extra content over there. It helps keep the show ad-free. And as an avid podcast listener myself, I know that a lot of other podcasts have a commercial every 10 to 15 minutes. And sometimes they are horrible commercials, and I don't want to have that on this show. It's been really nice to not have advertisers and to just do the show, no ad breaks, that sort of thing. I want to keep it that way. There's a bunch of software I have to pay for and some other things to run the show. And that's really what I'm trying to cover here. So if you want to support the show, if you're a frequent listener, you can donate on a one-time basis or monthly or whatever you want to do. So check it out if you're interested in keeping the show ad-free and just the show going on, because I'm telling you, I'm not going to do ads unless, well, if you got a boatload of money, you want to talk, shoot me an email if you want to. But anyway, let's get to the conversation with Rebecca and I'll shut up. Let's go. Rebecca, I'm pumped to have you on the show. We've chatted many times in person and we finally lined things up, and we'll get into some other details later, but I want to jump into the middle of the story here. You retired fairly quickly. I think the path was something like 4 to 5 years, and it wasn't exactly what you expected. And I think one of the key pieces, you and your husband were thinking, hey, we want to live in a smaller city, but it didn't quite work out how you thought. So what happened?
Yeah. So we were living in Boston at the time, and we pulled the early retirement trigger during COVID. So I think a lot of people might have been exploring this at the time, because maybe some people were getting laid off. Maybe people were finding that they didn't love their jobs because they were stuck at home and things were just dramatically different for everyone. And so we were stuck. Boston was one of those places that really locked down hard and fast. So we were both living with 3 roommates at the time. We felt very constrained. And we had talked previously about this plan to explore moving out of Boston. And then COVID just really catalyzed that, which I think is true for a lot of people. Like, a lot of people moved out of cities, they wanted more space. And so at the time we were looking at the idea of what I call like tertiary cities. I worked in commercial real estate for a long time, so I like to use this nomenclature. And so we wanted to live in a mountain town that had access to skiing, that was near a decent airport so that we could get home to our families easily. And we really believed at the time that we wanted to live in a smaller city that had a tight-knit community, but still had resources. Like, we didn't want to go so small that there wouldn't be options for things, or there wouldn't be resources, or say like good quality hospitals, but we wanted just something smaller than Boston, New York, Singapore. Those are the other places I lived. So we came up with this Excel file, of course, right? With 6 to 7 mountain towns on it. And actually one of them was Bozeman, Doug. So, and I know you live there, so probably should have talked to you about it. And our plan was to visit these 6 places. So we were both not working anymore. And the plan was to go to each place for anywhere between a few weeks and a few months to really just be there and experience it. So we sold everything we owned, distilled down to our Highlander, our Toyota Highlander. So everything we owned was in there and kind of started to explore. And the first place was Bozeman. We did really like it, but it is very, very hard to get to Montana, to Albany, New York. That's like not an easy flight.
Yeah, it's like a day plus, and then weather issues for a lot of the year for both places, right?
Right. And so we actually really loved it, but we found functionally it wasn't the right spot. And the next place on the list was Ogden, Utah, which we rented an Airbnb for 3 months. And we had planned to go to all these other places like Longmont, Colorado. And then we were in Ogden. We're like, you know what? Let's just stay. We like it enough. We're actually not as nomadic as we thought we could be. And so let's just stay here. So we never actually finished the experiment.
Gotcha. Interesting. Going back to Bozeman, that was kind of similar to what we did in 2015. We sold our stuff in Atlanta and we slow traveled for about 3 months in Montana, Whitefish for a little while, which we realized that is a little too small. I think at the time, about 3,000 people.
Lovely, but small.
Yeah, super cool. And I don't know. Yeah, like I need a little bit of a bigger town. We spent 6 months in Bozeman and it was like the prime of the summer. So like kind of everything was perfect. The place we were trying to be able to fly back to if needed was Atlanta, which has a huge airport. There are some direct flights, so a little bit easier to fly. And we stayed in Bozeman instead of moving to the Front Range in Colorado, where eventually we ended up a few years later, but we were like, Bozeman is super cool. So we stayed and we weren't going, like we didn't have the plan to go to the different places like you mentioned. So interesting. Now we're going to come back to the Longmont conversation because you did stop by here for a little while. We'll save that for a bit. So what was it about the size of the city that worked or didn't work as you were kind of exploring around?
Yeah. So we call it the Wasatch Front here in Utah. So it's similar to the Front Range in that you have Denver and then you have cities that are smaller, like Longmont North or Colorado Springs South. Like we have a similar style here. So Ogden's north of Salt Lake City and then Provo is south of Salt Lake City. And then there's kind of this suburban sprawl in between. So we're not suburban sprawl people at all. We don't love to be in a car. We were city people, right? So we are used to these walking density elements. We didn't have dreams of having acres and acres. In fact, I don't even have a garden. So just, you know, I think a small floor plate home. And so we were looking for a city that was compact, had a downtown area, had access to these things like, you know, multiple libraries, multiple hospitals, airport connectivity, and density. And then, of course, what's very important to me and my husband is access to skiing because we are self-proclaimed ski bums. There are some years where we get like 70 days in if we're lucky. And so Ogden fit the bill. And then the other thing about Ogden was ski towns are expensive. Like if you want to live in a place near a mountain, ski towns are expensive. And Utah is this interesting exception in that there's multiple world-class ski resorts within 45 minutes of major cities. Whereas Longmont's a little farther away from some of the major ski resorts out on I-70. So Salt Lake is this pretty, Salt Lake and the surrounding areas, you live at 4,000 feet, you drive up into the mountains, you get to 9,000 feet, you can reach them in 30 minutes. And so it'll be like dumping snow in the mountains, but then you'll come back to your house and you don't even have to shovel your driveway because it's like that high desert Utah culture. So it's a pretty nice combination. Whereas like most places in Colorado, if you're living in the Rocky Mountains, like you're up at elevation, it's snowing for half the year. It's pretty cold. And so it's just a little different here. And so that really appealed to us. And Ogden itself, where we lived, was a 20-minute drive away from world-class skiing. So we really liked that. And then also, Ogden is cheap. It's kind of still undiscovered. I mean, the prices there, like so many cities, have gone up so much. But we're talking about you could still buy a single-family home for $325,000 there today. And that's, I think, very rare in general for desired cities and especially cities within 20 minutes of skiing. So on paper, Ogden seemed just like right for us. And so we just decided to take the plunge and really invest ourselves there in that city and that community.
So one thing, and we'll get to some of your backstory because you retired fairly quickly, but largely this is like a post-FI podcast and we'll cover a little bit, but you mentioned before we started recording that you owned your home outright, I guess in Boston, right? And then now you're renting. So if I missed some portion of the question, but you're renting now, correct?
We rent now. Yeah. So we were renting in Boston. So we were living very urban and I had three roommates. Joe had three roommates. Part of our FI plan was like spending as little money as possible as part of that rent process. And then the plan was to move somewhere and buy a home. And work on that home, buy like a fixer upper, if you will, which by the way, never had bought a home before, never had fixed up a home before. So probably would have been a good idea to like try on one house project before I dove right in. And so we did buy our house outright in cash in Ogden because for us, something like $300,000 was doable and affordable and made sense for us to commit to that. And we're very lucky to be able to do that. We recently, so fast forward, right? We lived in Ogden for about 4 years. Fast forward, we recently moved to Salt Lake City as part of our choice to explore new places. And we can talk about that more. But now we are renting. We're renting a single family home in a very desired neighborhood here in Salt Lake. And it is by far and away the most rent we have ever spent. And so I think our exploration in FI is really interesting because, I mean, you talk to a bunch of people in the FI world and like, I think most people are trying to figure out how to reduce their costs for a long period of time, keep things low as possible so they can keep their taxes low. And I don't know many other people who have just made the choice to like leave their low cost of living lifestyle and just like jump into a higher cost lifestyle. I mean, this is also happening at the same time that we had our first kid. I have another kid on the way. We're sending that kid to daycare. So our expenses have gone up like 40 to 50%. And we're just, we're leaning into that, you guys. We're leaning into it.
Yes, I think you're right. We're in an interesting spot. And I guess like when you stopped working and explored around, like the markets have done well and a lot of us have oversaved a little bit. And then we talked to some folks that are ahead of us on the journey and maybe they've retired 5 or 10 years ago. And they're like, well, our expenses changed, like yours are changing, but it turns out everything was fine. Again, we've had really good market returns over the last many years, but there are a handful of people that are on the other side and they oversaved and they're like, we need to spend more. So maybe we're not like actively seeking higher cost of living places, but it's like, this works in our projections long-term and it doesn't seem like there's a huge downside to increase your spending. And I'm assuming like you pulled together some spreadsheets, even though your expenses went up, things are fine, even with the higher rent that you're paying and all that kind of stuff. Can you talk about sort of the mindset shift on that?
Yeah. So that original Excel spreadsheet that I talked to you about with the 6 to 7 mountain towns on it, also, we also use that information to plug into another calculator, which if you guys haven't seen it, the Fineers have a template called the 5 Milestones template, and you can plug all your data into it, into different scenarios, and it will output like where you are on the path to COSFI, and then also how much active income you would need to generate in any given year if you have not yet reached COSFI. So Jess from the Fineers, she runs it. She's awesome. She encouraged me to like explore this concept of how much active income we would need. So we plugged in each city like Bozeman, Ogden, Longmont, and like estimated what we think we would spend on a house and how that would then detract from our portfolio. As a result, it would be like, okay, if we're going to live off the 4% rule, how far along are we and how much active income we would need? And so at the time, we found that like there wasn't as big of a variance if you used that terminology. So if you looked at the cost of homeownership in Ogden, say Truckee, Lake Tahoe, that's a huge variance in homeownership costs. And so if you look at those numbers, it's going to immediately probably push you to Ogden. But then if you look at it in terms of, okay, well, how much active income do I need to generate for the rest of my life? It looked something more like, okay, we're 5 if we move to Ogden, and we would need to generate maybe $7,000 or $8,000 a year to cover our costs till the age of 65 if we move to Truckee. So that like mindset shift and looking at our portfolio in a different way was really helpful. We still landed on Ogden because I think we liked it at the time. And also it was like, well, why not? Then we're fully FI. But what we found over time is, well, okay, let me take a step back. So once we made the choice to move to Ogden, we really invested ourselves in that community. And, you know, sometimes you meet people and they can be like, oh, I'm having a hard time making friends. But you kind of know that they're maybe not necessarily putting themselves out there because it's hard for them. Joe, my husband and I, like we really committed ourselves. We really, really put ourselves out there. We host a weekly burrito night every Sunday where we cook for unlimited amounts of people. We volunteer, we got engaged, and we made good friends, like thoughtful friends, but something just like never clicked. Like we would fly back on a plane from a trip, land, drive home, and we just never felt like it was home. But we really, really wanted it to be our home. So we grappled with that idea so much. And there were a couple things going on, right? It was COVID, or it was a post-COVID world. I was like in my late 30s. We moved cities and we were not working in the traditional sense. So our lives looked really different. And it was really hard to grapple with the idea of like, what is the root of our problem? And is it COVID? Is it I'm old? Is it my life is different? And I spent so much time thinking about that root that we finally just gave up and just said, forget the root. We just have to make a change. And part of that change was exploring new cities. And also part of that change was knowing that we would have to leave a house that we own outright and explore cities like Longmont and Salt Lake, which you know about that experiment we did, and we could talk about that more. But also knowing that we would probably have to spend a ton more money. Mm-hmm. I think to go back to your original question, I think the realization that having things be cost effective doesn't necessarily mean you're living like the happy, fulfilling life that you want to live. And we did get kind of trapped in that scarcity mindset of, well, we're fully FI. What does it mean to potentially move away from being fully FI in order to lean into living in places that really mean a lot to us? And I remember one of the first books that I read that I really enjoyed, that I really connected with was the Playing with Fire book. Mm-hmm. And in it, the family moves away from San Diego to Bend, Oregon, right?
Sounds right, yeah.
But I remember in the book reading like how much they loved San Diego. And I thought at the time, like, wow, you guys really love this place. Is there a way that you can stay in San Diego? And I remember thinking that like super early on in my FI journey. So it's funny that didn't translate to our own experience, you know, now. But I think, you know, that combined with the fact that we've now had 6 years of living off of dividends and interest, drawing money down from our portfolio, we have not really earned an active income in any way, shape, and form. The two of us, we've been living off of marketplace healthcare, and like we're doing it, and our portfolios are bigger than they were when we left our jobs. And I know market returns have been really good, but I think when you just look at all that data, look at that we didn't have what we wanted, it just finally clicked for us. And we're like, okay, let's take a chance here.
Yeah. And it's so, like you said, good market returns, it's not always going to be like that. But then, yeah, like I have so many conversations with folks. It's like, holy shit, you've been doing everything that you've wanted to do for the last several years, and you have more money than you did when you stopped. It's like, yeah.
And I think the truth of the matter is probably in the first couple of years, we weren't really withdrawing 4% because we were just too nervous for the first time. So like now, okay, we'll take these couple of years and just like maybe do 5%, and that's okay.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Like we have a financial advisor for the last couple of years, and it gave my wife more confidence in our projections, and it gives us an intermediary for our communication issues and stuff, which we've gotten much better. And she retired, everything's good. But I stopped looking at it from a percentage of a withdrawal rate basis because we're far below where we could be based on our normal rules. But we're looking at very super long timelines, and the main job of a financial advisor is like, don't run out of money. So it's like fairly conservative, and over time, similar to what you're saying, I think after we have a few years in the sequence of returns, risk has kind of gone away, and we're way ahead of where we thought we might be in 5 years or something like that. Like we'll have to adjust. Otherwise we're going to have a compound interest snowball going down the hill that we got to catch up with, which is hard, like once it gets going. So,
yeah. Curious to ask you, because I think that you and your wife are a little similar to me and my husband, where I'm a little more conservative and he's probably a bit more confident and a risk taker. Yeah. How did you guys come to the conclusion to hire a third party and feel confident in that decision? Was it tough for you?
It wasn't too bad, but it took some time. So you, a good read. Yeah. I'm more, I guess, risky, but basically like I have like a more of an entrepreneurship mindset. So I'm like, if I needed to create some value and earn some money, I think I could probably do it, and I could probably do it on my own terms. And the main thing is like, I knew that we did need some help with like our communication, and Elizabeth, my wife, mentioned like, all right, I would be confident retiring if we had, you know, a lot more due diligence. And her, one of the biggest fears was that she would stop working, and then due to lack of planning or a mistake, that she would have to work again, which is not the end of the world, but she just didn't want to make a mistake based on incompetence of a projection, right? Like we just goofed up. And because we had many different folks look at it and a professional that we paid, then she was very confident. I think we worked a little too long and blah, 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 but we still view it a little differently. And there's still some debate on like, how much should we spend on this or that, or how are we tracking certain things? Cause, and from where I sit, I'm like, do we need to track things as closely as we did before? I mean, it makes her feel better, so we do. But for me, I'm like, as long as we're like within the parameters, and again, we have kind of a wide safety net of margin of error built in. And I'm like, we could kind of fuck this up a little bit and it probably wouldn't be a big deal, but she doesn't operate that way. So we've met in the middle, and hiring someone has worked out well. It's a good guy. And I would recommend, you know, if people want to have an advisor that's sort of fee only, advice only, that is not charging a percentage. You don't, it's not like you're marrying them. You could hire them for a year or two, get things in order. You could, if it doesn't work out, work with someone else. It's not like you're signing everything over. You could just work with whoever you want for whatever amount of time. So, especially with the fee only, advice only.
Yeah. We're kind of leaning into the idea of, I think you bring up the good point. It's a good intermediary. I also think it's a good, I think when you're in a couple, you can just talk about the same things over and over again, and you can kind of go in these circles, and having a third party there to just be a catalyst to honestly force you to make a decision and go in a direction or take a baby step forward is useful. And I'm the type of person where it can take me a really long time to try something because there's just friction, I'm nervous. But then once I do it, I don't need a lot of baby steps after that. I will just go ahead and do that thing.
Yeah.
So it's like I have to just jump off the cliff, basically. And so I think like an hourly, once in a while conversation with a third party could really help us. Not necessarily like, I don't think we need someone to help us with our full financial plans, at least not right now, but just someone to help us think through the questions that we just like in our bubble are constantly talking about and probably do know the right answer to, but just someone to say, have you thought about this or have you thought about this? So I'm lightly exploring the idea of like, you know, Hello Nectarine or a service like that where you can work with someone just like for an hour or two once in a while to just make sure you're working in the right direction.
Perfect. Yeah. Like a little deeper, did you guys have any debate? I'll just phrase it that way. Debate on like when to retire, stop working, that kind of thing based on like more conservative or more aggressive projections?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that Excel file of, okay, we have an idea of what we're going to spend. We have an idea of how much money we need, but we don't have an idea of exactly where we want to live and how much our home will cost. So we really hinged the FI plan on how much would it cost to buy a home outright in cash. You guys, I don't know if this is the right way to do it or not, but this is like how we did it because that's what we were looking at the time. That's what was most important to us. So like when I go back to that Excel spreadsheet, it was like, okay, I could work for two or three more years, or I could just earn active income in the realm of $6,000 to $10,000 a year. And you spoke about this, like when we first started this app, which was like my journey to FI was really short. It was only 4 to 5 years. I think most people we meet, that's not the case for them. And so Joe, my husband again, who introduced me to FI, like when he first introduced it to me, I was like, you are a crazy person. And not because of the investing fundamentals or the math behind it, but generally it was just because I thought that work was your value. And my identity was very wrapped up into being a commercial real estate researcher. It was a very big part of who I was. And my family is very much so like work is important. Productivity is important. And so when I learned about it, I was already a crazy saver. I was very lucky. I had very high paying jobs. I was well on the path there. And so it was this short time period where I spent the majority of the time like catching up on financial literacy education and just making sure I had all the FI things in order versus thinking, really actually thinking about what life would look like post-retirement. I almost think I want to say I wasn't thinking about that. Like I was just like, okay, how do we get there? Okay, we're close to being there. And then like you, Doug, I was in a situation where I'd moved to a new company. They were doing layoffs and there was a third round of layoffs. And I was just so over like the final push of FI, even though I'd only been on the journey for a couple years. I was just over the process, over COVID, over these Zoom calls. And so I asked if I could be included in that third round of layoffs. So I had that golden parachute, if you will, by choice, which was nice. So I'd only worked for that company for 8 months, but got paid for 12 months. I think that's a pretty good ROI.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a little bit of a forcing function for us. Like, we don't think we're quite fully FI, but if we move to Ogden, we probably will be, but maybe we're not. But you know what? We just got to move on and try something new.
Gotcha. Man, so much good stuff in there. I kept saying we're going to talk about the journey. So we'll quickly, this is a boring part. It sounds like you kind of described it, but you were introduced to FI by Joe. What year was that roughly?
2018.
Okay. Cool.
2017? One of those years, Doug.
Somewhere in there. Okay, cool. thought, like most of us, it's a little crazy. And then you learned more, you saw some examples, you did more research, and you were like, oh, the math works. These people, there's so much information that probably true. And then you tweaked a couple things, probably lowered expenses, it sounds like, and then just focused on savings.
Yeah. So for me, like I wasn't like exactly a super frugal person, but I had the big stuff figured out, like the rent, the car. But then I really did head into that world of, okay, let's play with this. Let's actually see what my savings rate could be. And so I stopped spending money hardcore. I don't know how to explain it. Classic mustachianism, rode my bike to work, was very thoughtful. I luckily had a community of friends that we spent really meaningful times together in ways that weren't expensive or complicated. So it's very easy to do this. So I think I just leaned into it very hardcore, which, to be honest, is not a bad thing. I think it's a good experience to strip your life of things that could or could not matter, get down to your core values and like work up from there. I think that was actually an honestly very good pilot for me. And also I was making a decent amount of money at the time. So it was a good time to save, right? You can kind of do these stints like, hey, I'm living at home for a little bit, or hey, I'm just reducing my expenses a lot for a year, knowing that it's not permanent, just to kind of push cash into the funnel to work for you in the future. The other thing was I've been working for the same company for 10 years. I know I'm the only millennial doing this. And it was a good company. I had a lot of great peers and really good projects, but I definitely was stuck in that 3-5% raise type of world. And FI really gave me the confidence to take chances. And so I was offered a job at another company that was a startup. And it was kind of known within our world that I have a more of like a consulting background like you, Doug. Like I would consult large developers and companies on what to do with their real estate portfolios. And so one of the clients that I had worked with was like, do you want to come and work with us? And it was perceived to be a risky move. And I was like, you know what? Why not? And most of my colleagues were like, are you sure? Like you want to go there? There's a chance that they might collapse and fail. And I was like, you know what? Yeah. Cause like, who cares if they collapse and fail? Because I'm very far along on the path to FI. I didn't say that anyone. And they doubled my salary, Doug.
Wow.
And it was, I just, in the process of like being so close to FI, I was just so willing to take risk, like A, move to a company that was likely to fail. B, move to a company, or sorry, A, move to a company that was likely to fail, and B, just in that interview process, just be super bold. Like they were like, well, you have to move to New York. And I was just like, no, I won't be moving to New York. And they were like, okay, you don't have to do that. Or they're like, this is going to be your salary. And I was like, actually, can you just add 50K to that? I would have never done things like that 10 years ago. So I was very emboldened. And so then that move, even though I talked about it earlier, like I was only there for 8 months with that 4 month severance package, that moved escalated our timeline to FI by just like 2 to 3 years, because I had like an 85%, 90% savings rate in that time frame. So I feel very, very, very fortunate. A lot of that was luck, but also a lot of it was like this newfound confidence that I just had never had before without all the fuck you money.
Yeah. That's a great story. And yeah, I totally hear you. Like I imagine that if I would go to a job interview, I could probably do a much better job now because I don't want or need the job.
And you could
just be a little more truthful and bold and yeah, very cool. All right.
And also maybe define what you wanted to do in that job, right? Not necessarily just get more money, but if they were like, we're thinking about having you do this, you could probably feel confident enough to say, I don't think that's actually the right plan for you guys.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, on top of that, like you're interviewing them, like who would I be working with, and really kind of check them out. And we say that as people that are probably not going to try to get a job. So this, it's all in theory. I'm not going to do any of this.
You don't want to be a consultant again, Doug?
Oh my gosh. No. Oh, I couldn't imagine. That would be just horrible.
I weirdly think I could do it again.
Oh, really?
For like 6 months.
Okay. I wonder if it was the right industry and fun people to work with, but that's not the telecom industry that I was in before. A lot of people work in that industry. You're fine outside of work, but I don't want to work with you anymore. So, okay. Very good. Any other notes on the journey? Oh, I have a little follow-up and then you could pepper anything else. It sounds like you were saving pretty well and you were doing the right things most of the time. Just curious as far as 401k, a Roth versus a post-tax brokerage account. Did you have a post-tax to have some flexibility if you stopped working very early and that sort of thing? Or did you have access to other cash or something like that?
Yeah. So I think this is a bit of luck too. So in terms of the amount of money that I was making and when I was deploying the five principles over that time frame, we were maxing everything out and then also had enough left over to put into just a brokerage account. I also, luckily through my company, was able to do a mega backdoor Roth. So that really helped push the retirement portfolios. It's worth checking to see if your company offers something like that. It's called a mega backdoor Roth. And so we were doing all those things. And before I learned about FI, I had more investments, but they were in a brokerage account because I wasn't aware of all the pros of having your money in a tax-advantaged account. So my portfolio is kind of unique compared to most other people in the community because I actually have a lot in my taxable account. And some people are often struggling to figure out how to get their money and how to access their money more quickly. And so we're solely just living off of, dividends, interest, and withdrawals when necessary from that taxable account. My husband's portfolio as well. So we have a lot to play with in there, I guess, just due to the luck of not knowing what I was doing.
Yes. I did not realize it. Many parallels, exactly the same. It was through ignorance that we ended up. We have about 2/3 of our net worth in taxable. So huge amount of flexibility, not tax optimized, but I mean, there's waste in the system, blah, blah, blah. Everything worked out fine. But if you look at pure returns, maybe we didn't have the best returns, but we have a lot of access and a lot of flexibility.
Right. And better that you probably did something with the money than nothing at all.
Totally. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Any other notes before we transition into Longmont?
No. I mean, I think my journey post-FI is much more complicated and nuanced than my journey pre-FI.
All right. You spent some time here in Longmont as part of the experiment if I have all the timeline correct now. I'm curious about the cities that were tested, and you hung out here for a little while, and I remember we played pickleball, and I think I saw you a couple other times around here, but yeah, you decided to check out Longmont.
Okay, so that original exploration list was the 6 to 7 towns. We only got to 2 of them, Bozeman and Ogden. So fast forward 4 years later, we go to a Camp FI Rocky Mountain, which you came to and recorded an episode of your podcast as well there. And I showed up and kind of softly said oh, I don't really know if we love where we live. And there were some, for sure, Longmont enthusiasts there who I've come to become very good friends with, lovely people who are Longmont, we think you love it. And that started planting the seed really for us to make a change. I think I was 5 months pregnant at the time. And I think we realized it was probably time for a change soon and that maybe we should have explored all those 6 mountain towns originally and maybe we shouldn't have jumped the gun so quickly. And so very slowly, we kind of put a plan into action. We came out to once our son was born, we came out to Longmont actually in the summertime for a week or two, stay with some of your friends and just got to explore it. And then, like I told you earlier, I'm a little slow to do things, but once I commit, I commit. So we're okay, let's execute on part 2 of this exploration plan. And we're going to explore Longmont, seriously, and Salt Lake. And Salt Lake is only 45 minutes south of us, or south of Ogden. Mm. So you wouldn't think that we needed to explore it. But what we found was you could visit. How often do you go on vacation, Doug, and you like walk into a coffee shop or brewery and you're like, oh, I could live here. And you pull up Zillow.
Yeah. Every time we go somewhere.
I think a lot of people can relate to this, but I truly think you need to be somewhere to live and breathe that community to really know if you want to live there. And I'm a social person. Like, community is really, really important to me. And so we said, okay, let's do 6 weeks in Longmont and 6 weeks in Salt Lake City, which is 45 minutes south of us, and just be there. Let's go to the playground with our son. Let's drive to the ski mountains and see what traffic is like. Let's go grocery shopping. Let's say hi to people on the street and really commit to this. And so we started first with Longmont, inspired by Campfire Rocky Mountain. And then we went directly to an Airbnb in Salt Lake City in the neighborhood that we thought we might want to live in.
How did you rank these? When we do stuff like this, pros, con list, it's a weighted matrix, that kind of bullshit, you know? Did you guys do the same thing where you're like, okay, there's all these factors and we're evaluating it and you have a numerical representation at the end?
I love that you said that. Because that's, as the consultant, right, in us, that's probably what I would have done. And I was thinking, like, there's no document here where I can rank this on a scale of 1 to 5, where any of this is going to make sense. So we actually made a promise to ourselves to not do that.
Oh, you did.
Exact
good
thing. Because smart. We just said we need to go with our gut. And also we kind of knew, like, look, if we ended up in Salt Lake or Longmont, that it was a change. And we just needed a change. Like, we were just in a rut. And so when we came to Longmont, like, and by the way, shout out to the community of Longmont. Like, I think we met a lot of people in our time there. I've reached out to most of you personally. I just want to say, like, thank you so much for your generous time and letting us trial your wonderful city for 6 weeks and investing in us. I mean, it really was a beautiful experience. I think the thing that happened foremost when we got to Longmont is we realized, oh shit, we have really been missing out. Like, look at this beautiful community. Look how generous they are. Just the ability to, like, share knowledge, share tools, share time, show up for each other when people are sick and ill. I just think, like, just seeing the beauty that you guys have in your community really made me and Joe realize, like, that, wow, that's something that we want. So the second we just left Ogden and arrived in Longmont, we were just like, it was like just truly a breath of fresh air. We got to spend 6 weeks with you guys, although I will say I was plagued with a lot of illnesses. And I think norovirus was going around then. My God, I felt like I was sick the whole time. Oh. Brutal. But one of the things that was tough for us about Longmont, if can I say, is that okay?
Yeah. I'm curious the
the long
issues, yeah.
I know I don't want to upset the Longmont fan club because it is really awesome. But the two things that were hard for us was we were previously, like I said, 20 minutes from a ski resort, and now we were much farther away from skiing. And skiing is truly a big part of our lives. It brings us a lot of joy. And Eldora, which is the closest ski mountain, is a proper hour away still. And then beyond that, it's anywhere between 2 hours and 8 hours to get to.
It's crazy. Yeah. For the people that don't know, it's like traffic. There's an interstate, Highway 70, but obviously there's snow and ice, and then like a million people trying to get to the mountains whenever there's fresh powder, which is like all the time. So that's an issue.
Right. And so what we realized is, and you know, we have a 2-year-old now and a baby on the way, and we realized that we probably would never go skiing. And we actually went skiing once the entire time we were in Longmont. And so we had to say to ourselves, this is like indicative, probably, like, well, we're testing the situation. So this is indicative. And were we willing to, like, kind of walk away from that? And at the same time, we live really far away from our families. Part of the reason for that is because of access to mountain skiing and the outdoors. And so it's like, okay, do we want to sacrifice that if we're not actually then doing those things that we love? Second piece was, I'm Jewish. Joe's not. I'm Jewish. We're raising our children Jewish. And there were no real, there is an organization, but there were no synagogues that we wanted to join in Longmont. And so we found like, what we found is we were going to Boulder a lot, which depending on where you, how far of a drive do you live from Boulder proper?
That's probably 15 miles, 20, 30 minutes, depending on traffic.
Yeah. So it could, right. So it could be somewhere. I think, you know, we were staying with a friend who was more like 15, 20 minutes. She's closer to that side, but we found like, oh man, we're going to probably be commuting to Boulder multiple times a week. And we're just not, as I said earlier, we're not like commuty people. And we really wanted to be in the place. Like if we, like if Isaac started going to religious school in Boulder and all of his friends lived in Boulder, then he wouldn't be living near his friends. And as to both you and me, it's very important to live near the people that we love and care about. So that was a secondary factor there. And so we said, you know what? We really love it here. The people here are incredible. The lifestyle is incredible. Let's explore Salt Lake. We weren't quite sure we were ready to give up on Utah yet. I will also say softly, and we really tried to not let this influence the decision, Longmont is way more expensive in all ways, shapes, and forms than Utah, from everything from like getting a cup of coffee to hiring a babysitter. So we did feel that sticker shock a little bit. And that was that first, we had talked about that, like, okay, we need to be prepared for the sticker shock. But I definitely felt the Colorado versus the Utah difference there. And then we said goodbye to everyone in Longmont. It was very sad. And then we came to Salt Lake. And I actually think the order of going to Colorado first, breaking out of like the rut that we were in, being around people who were beautiful and caring was a good thing to do first. Cause then we came to Salt Lake and we realized like, oh, it's not Utah that we were struggling with. It was truly just like Ogden wasn't a great fit for us. And so we were really able to like settle in here, find a rhythm. We found we were skiing way more, even though we have a toddler. We were able to meet people super duper quickly, even in just that those 6 weeks. And so from that process, we said, you know what, we're not ready to give up on Utah. And so be it, if we end up in Longmont, like in 2 years from now, like, please don't be angry at me, anyone, if I come crawling back 2 years from now. But so far we've been here 6 months and it's been promising. It's been a really positive experience.
Were you able to figure out like what it was in Ogden that you weren't connecting with? Was it the specific community? And if there's no real answer, that's okay. Just curious if you've been able to identify anything.
Yeah. And I think I spoke to that earlier with this concept of like, we were just constantly exploring for the root of the problem so that we could solve it. We had good friends. We had a home that we lived in all cash. We were close to our favorite ski mountain, Snow Basin. It's still our favorite ski mountain. Sometimes like the chemistry just isn't there in a place that you live. Like sometimes the building blocks are there, but things don't just add up. Like I found, and again, no hate on Ogden. I found that people who generally live in Ogden, like probably are more keep to themselves type folks. So in the umpteen million times that I went to the playground with my son, I can count on one hand how many people I talked to full stop or who talked to me. I go to the park now in Salt Lake and it's like 10 people talk to me in any given time. And I have to be like, please, no autographs. This is like too much. And so there's just something about the spirit. I don't know why. I'm curious. Like, I would love to be an anthropologist in this experiment of why this is the way it is. But I just found that people are a little more outgoing here than they are. And also Salt Lake has, I need to be like very honest that I'm from New York. I moved to Utah. It is a very different culture than what I grew up with. And there are more transplants from similar cultures to Salt Lake than there were to Ogden. So I just naturally am connecting with the transplant community here that want similar things from life. And it's just been a little bit easier.
Yeah. Interesting. And also, as you mentioned, Ogden's only like 45 minutes away. So you wouldn't think it's like a huge dramatic change,
yeah.
But like like neighborhoods have a different atmosphere, whether it's like social, like literally chatting with each other, or like the other amenities that are around, like you mentioned. I mean, Boulder's only like 15 miles away. And maybe if you're, like you said, if you're like commuting up and down, while it's a nice drive, you can see the Flatirons and the mountains, you don't want to sit in the car.
Do you guys find that you stick to Longmont mostly, or do you like go to Denver? Do you go to Boulder, go to some of these bigger places?
We do stick to the few mile radius around here. As we get older, it's hard to even get me on the other side of Longmont. I'm like, oh, it's like 15 minutes away. Meanwhile, like back in Atlanta, I would drive like an hour and a half, meet people for lunch or whatever. And then here I'm like, oh man, I don't know if I could drive all the way to, you know, halfway to Boulder or whatever, where it's like, it takes 10 minutes.
That's so interesting, right? Cause you came, like Atlanta, Dallas, these are the super commuter cities, and you are used to that. I'm curious how you came to look at smaller cities.
My stress level dropped dramatically when we left Atlanta. I mean, I wasn't even commuting to, I was working remotely when, by the time we moved, but even just like driving around a little bit, I'm annoyed and that sort of thing. I'm much better now because I'm typically not in any sort of a hurry or anything, and I can travel when there's less traffic. However, I just got back from Atlanta a few days ago, and it kind of doesn't matter like when you're driving around. There's like kind of a lot of traffic all the time, and we were going across town. So I grew up in the suburbs and my wife did too. So like we're comfortable with the endless sprawl and strip malls and Target, Walmart, all that kind of stuff. Like it feels like home. So this is kind of a good spot for us. And we occasionally still go to a big city for vacation, or we'll, if we go down to Denver, a lot of times I'm like, okay, for a show, let's just get a hotel so we don't have to like do this whole thing and we don't know how long it'll take. So often we'll just make a night of it and kind of skip that portion of it and do a few more activities and that sort of thing. All that to also say, visiting a big city can be fun, but I think it would wear me out pretty quickly. I'm adaptable, but like I like, you know, bigger open spaces and that sort of thing versus like living in the city, which I did in Atlanta some.
Yeah. Salt Lake, I think, has been a nice blend of that too. It is a city. There's museums, there's hot, big known hospitals, but it still feels very close knit. So I think it's been a nice blend for us as in a nice way. Whereas before, I think my mindset was a little bit more like, oh, I have to choose between a super city and a small place. And I'm beginning to see what it actually is like to be in some of these different sorts of cultures and sizes of cities.
And you guys are renting a house now. Is it in a neighborhood or is it like an old part of town, or what's it kind of like around there?
Yeah. So we're in this neighborhood called Sugar House. There's kind of like two commercial areas in Salt Lake City. There's downtown, and then there's Sugar House. And so we live within 5 minutes, 10 minutes walking of Sugar House. There's multiple grocery stores, there's coffee shops, there's a library, there's public transportation, like a light rail, but we live on a street with a bunch of single family homes. And so we downsized from a slightly larger house to like a rambler style, 3-bed, 2-bath, but pretty small and close knit, which by the way, I love, like less to clean, less to take care of. So it feels like it's really perfect for us. Like it's dense, but no one's on top of us. It's not apartment living. And so choosing our home has actually worked out really, really, really well. And we were particular. We were hawks on the Craigslist, Zillows. I think within the first 4 hours, this house had 18 applications on Zillow, but we were like psychos. We applied in 1 minute and were the first people to apply, had a good credit score. But also, I don't know if you've ever like seen a Zillow rental application, but they ask for your income. And so we have to be like, please see comments and then expand on our story and share our portfolio information, because a lot of landlords get a little freaked out about that. But that aside, we found a good housing setup. And I know, like, before we started the episode, we were talking a little bit. You guys are maybe potentially looking at what it could be to maybe change your housing situation too.
Yeah. And Elizabeth and I have been talking about this a little bit, and I think far in the future. So no one panic or anything like that. So we have a new construction, and it's very comfortable. It's maybe a little bit too big. It sounds like maybe roughly the size of your place. It's like a 2-bedroom, but there's a studio or library. I don't know. It's just like a room that doesn't have a closet. So it's not a bedroom. So it's a 3-2, and there's like a half basement, which is where the studio is, and some other stuff down here. And there's only two of us. So it's a little bit too big. And to your point, to have like kind of just the right size home so that you don't have to do extra cleaning. And then we have a yard and there's maintenance and some other stuff like that. So Elizabeth she's describing it as like introducing the idea to me early, because she knows it'll take a while to convince me, especially like we're in it's a good little pocket right here. And to your point, if we were a few blocks that way or a little bit different where I can't walk to the same stuff, I wouldn't like it as much. So like it's kind of the perfect little location for this stuff that I do on a multiple times per day basis. So it is interesting. And like your area that you described where you could walk to some grocery stores or some other things around, there's a lot of parks in your neighborhood area too, I imagine. So it's like, those are the kind of things where I'm like, oh, I just said, I probably don't want to live in like a bigger city, but that sounds perfect because like that micro area of like a mile and a half or so sounds perfect, right? Like single family homes, you have a little yard, but not too big and all that kind of stuff, right? I'm a little nervous because it is such a good community here in Longmont. And I'm like, even if we moved a little further away, it could interfere with that dynamic. And it's like, is the upside enough to accept the downside with it, which could be like less community, less social, even if it's only like 15 minutes down the road, maybe we're closer to mountains, but we're farther from friends. So like, how does that work out?
I have a question and a thought.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, what is the true impetus for the move? Is it cost? Is it size?
I think it's size because there's much discussion that needs to happen, but I think it's probably mostly size and a little bit of like the home maintenance and that sort of thing. Truthfully, because we have a pretty good interest rate because we bought in 2020, if we tried to go somewhere else or rent, it would probably certainly be more expensive. Like there's just no way around it unless we move to like a crappier place, a much crappier place. So even if we got a smaller place, it would probably be more expensive. Side note, the other thing is like, we have a lot of house plants and like this time of year, occasionally you have to shovel snow and some other, again, home maintenance. So we have a dog, so we don't travel too much internationally or for too long, but she's 13. So in some years, hopefully she'll live very long, but in some years we won't have a dog and we probably will want to travel farther and longer. And there's just a little bit more simplicity if you're like, say, renting an apartment or have a rental where you're like, yep, I'm just leaving all that. Someone else is shoveling. Someone else is doing the other maintenance. So that's a secondary thing, I guess.
Yeah. I guess two sort of like conflicting thought processes that I have is the first, it brings me back to the San Diego example of playing with fire. It's like nothing's ever going to be perfect ever. I truly don't think there's any perfect home that anyone has. If they're telling you it's perfect, they're probably have rose colored glasses on. So it's like, if you love where you live, it works well enough. Why rock the boat is my first thought. I guess the conflicting thought is you could do something like Joe and I did, where you rent an Airbnb in like an approximate location somewhere else in Longmont and just live there for a week and just do the things that you do, like meet up with your friends, go to the grocery store, run the errands. Sometimes you may be surprised. I had a cousin who moved, I think, just a couple miles up the road in Southern California, and he moved in with his now fiance, and he was like, "Oh, I love my surfing spots, and I love my house, and I love my coffee shop." And he really wasn't sure how he'd feel about it. And then he ended up making the movie. He's like, "I found the best surfing spots. I found the best breakfast burritos." And I mean, these places are pretty close to each other, but he was very surprised at how positive it worked out. So maybe you can try the experiment that Joe and I did, Doug.
Yeah. Yeah. These are good questions, good ideas. And I think, you know, one thing I'm a little, again, like, this is a good spot. It's a good neighborhood. And it's like, if we sell it and we check some other stuff out, I'm like, ah, shit, you can't backtrack on that very easily. Like, to your point, I think maybe not exactly, but this is a pretty good neighborhood. And it's like one of the few new constructions around. So like, it's tough to get into this spot. But all that said, probably, like, did you say it was your cousin? Like your cousin, like, you could kind of just plop me somewhere and then I'm like, oh, everything's fine, you know. Like, I adapt really quickly and it would be totally fine. So let's see, one other area that I want to get into, because we could probably go on for another couple hours. But so you mentioned your professional identity, and that comes up all the time. It seems like you've shed some of those issues, but can you talk about transitioning from commercial real estate into retired person?
Yeah. So I'll caveat with the fact that my husband and I left our jobs at the same time, which I think most people don't do, unless they're doing something like traveling the world or starting a project together. I think we could probably both agree that most people don't pull the early retiree trigger at the same time. Joe was like absolutely fine, had no problems, no qualms in life, didn't need to re-identify himself into anything, was not anxious. And so we experienced these things very differently. And I'm very envious of that, by the way. But I had to do some self-work. Like I said, I worked for the same company for 10 years. Like, I actually recently gave a presentation to that company and I kept using words like "we." And I'm like, I'm not a "we" with them anymore. That's crazy. I'm not a part of this. And so I really had to work on that. And so around the time I had come into this program, at the time, it was called the Joy Collective, run by this woman named Carrie Ann Rockmore, who's also an early retiree. She is wonderful. She's a wonderful human being. And she had said to me, I think it probably will take the early retiree between 1 and 3 years to really figure out what they're doing. And she used the analogy of being on the trapeze, like you're holding on to the old bar, but you are holding on to the new bar at the same time. And if you don't let go, you're just going to kind of be stuck in purgatory. You just have to work on letting go and exploring moving forward. When I left my commercial real estate job, around the time I had started working on Yield and Spread, which is now this nonprofit that I run, which focuses on promoting generosity and giving in the world of personal finance. And so I found myself really just dumping myself into that project at the same rate and energy that I did my job. And so that was good because it really helped me lift Yield and Spread off the ground. But it also was like taking over my identity. And when I wasn't successful, and you've talked about this on your podcast too, like the idea of getting clicks, getting followers, generating revenue, whatever your KPIs are, when you're an entrepreneur and you're starting something new, and you're not successful at it, and if your whole identity is buried in that, it can be really upsetting. And so I think I struggled with, like, all I knew was this commercial real estate world beforehand. And I was just trying to apply those same measures of success to this new project, which was very different, very differently structured. And so I had to really just like work on how to balance Yield and Spread, and then also doing the whole early retiree thing, which was the whole point, which is like spending time with loved ones, skiing 70 days a year, taking care of myself, sleeping more, spending time with friends. And I think a combination of just doing that for longer, like I needed time to move away from the commercial real estate working identity, Boston identity, New York identity, Singapore identity. I needed time to move away from that and just to experience it and to be patient with myself. And then also, I think having a formal system for evaluating like that progression. So the Joy Collective had this thing called the Annual Clarity Retreat, which was this like, I think it was at the time like a 5 or 6 week program where we went through different elements to like what it means to live a joyful life. And week one was like your year in review. And then week three was like, well, writing down all your fears and how to combat them. And then at the end, it was coming up with your big goals for that year. And so I have a tendency to like bite off way more than I can chew. And I'll choose like 40 goals. And then I'll achieve them, by the way, and then be like, oh, I should have done 50 goals. So I can be a little type A. I call myself like a recovering type A. And so the Joy Collective created this space where it's like, actually, you have this one big goal and maybe two little goals. And like, that's it. And enjoy your free time. Enjoy the space to think. Enjoy time with your family. And I will say it took like 3 to 4 years of working on that. I still don't think I'm as chill and relaxed as Joe. I think another thing here is I became a mom, and that just like forced me to redirect for those issues that way. Did I really actually work through some of this? I try not to beat myself up over that too much because like highlight it, give myself time, came up with a system and structure to be able to manage how much I was biting off so that I could chew appropriately. And then also like, I became a mom, so I just had to think about someone else for once instead of just myself.
When you were redirecting your energy into yield and spread, did you realize it at the time that you were just doing that? Like, or when did you figure that out?
No, I did not realize at the time. It took me a while to regear. So Yield and Spread, which has a lot of offerings, but one of the initial core offerings was a Learn to Invest personal finance course. So I liked teaching people about personal finance. You've talked about this, like you find these interests, you kind of push on them for like 3 to 5 years and then you kind of move on. I'm similar in my style. So like at the time I obviously found out this really cool thing about FI and was like, okay, I would like to help people. I think a lot of people. And so I was teaching that course both live and online and donating all proceeds from that to high impact charities. So the thought process there being, okay, I've achieved FI. I don't really need this money. I'm trying to put my money where my mouth is. Why don't I do this skill that I'm really good at and then also donate the money to charity and do some good with that. And so the output of that was I need to be donating more dollars because A, that means the course is successful, and B, that means I'm helping others. And over time, as I became more involved in like these movements around like social justice, morality, philanthropy, I realized that I had a very numbers oriented brain and that I should think more about impact. And I found I could say work with 5 people who donated 10% of their income each year and help them with their financial plans for giving. And that would have the same impact, if not more, than selling courses and donating the money. So I ended up changing the way I think about yield and spread more towards impact and highest impact for lowest amount of work or effort or involvement, which really blended well with the early retiree stuff. And then that was able to really shape how I approached the nonprofit and the work that I did and the impact that I could have
One observation I've had with myself is how lazy I've gotten. It's amazing. So I don't do that much now. And I just do a couple podcasts per week. And I batch it. You know, it's not, I have producer Chris helping me out on this show and he volunteers. But you mentioned just being productive and like, you know, yeah. You were successful at work and you probably in school as well, like you got recognition for being productive. And then you talked about as you transitioned and got away from some of your old ways, you're like, oh, sleep more, which if you're like, oh, I take a nap each day or something like that, people would think you're lazy and then you have more leisure time and all this stuff. So how have you wrestled with that? If it's sort of a separate area where you're like, okay, you don't have to be productive all the time. You could read a book for leisure, read some fiction or whatever. How have you wrestled with that?
Yeah. I mean, first off, the language that we use, like you're saying, not to put you on the spot, but you're like, I'm lazier than I used to be.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Could the language just be rewritten as I don't do as much active work that earns active income anymore? Yes. But maybe you are still living life very meaningfully. I actually think a couple podcast episodes a week is a lot of work. I mean, people don't realize how much work can go into having a podcast and recording episodes and the prep you do it and the editing and the launching and the branding, etc. So that doesn't seem lazy at all to me. Yeah, you're doing a lot, Doug. You're also like showing up for your community in a ways that most people have full-time jobs and like they're not able to show up for things like that. So I think the language, I've really worked really hard. I think I'm still arguably a little bad at this, is to not be so hard on myself. And I try to use different language and I try to rewrite the narrative I have around myself. One of the things that I'm really struggling with is we have a toddler. And so I do feel as though I'm struggling to squeeze things in whenever I can. So I think in an ideal world, I would love to engage more in like the Cal Newport digital minimalism mindset. Minimalism? What is the title of the book? Sorry, Cal.
I think you got it. You got it with one of those.
You guys get the vibe. And basically like set up times of the week where I'm meant to be productive and engage with certain technologies and then not engage with those things elsewhere. Like, so for example, from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday through Thursday, that's when I check email and respond to email. Otherwise, you're not going to hear from me. I find it very, very, very hard to stick with that with a kid. And then also being pregnant, where sometimes I don't like have energy to do things, but other times I don't. So right now I do feel like I'm in a little free for all and it's very hard to define like when I'm working, when I'm not working. For example, like one of the things I kind of miss from working is I generally worked Monday through Friday. It would be a huge emergency for me to work on Saturday and Sunday. So when I got to Friday at 5, that you got that feeling of like, ah, it's the weekend. I don't really ever have that anymore. And so I would like to find that again, but I just don't know if I'm quite there with kids this age. But I think once we have kids who are in school, like Monday through Friday, my sincere hope is to like get to a better place and to do a better job at this.
Right. As we're wrapping up, I want to give you some time to talk a little bit more about yield and spread and like how people can learn more and that sort of thing. So I'll just open the floor and you can kind of tell us about it and if people want to explore and connect with you, what they should do.
Yeah. Yieldandspread.org is where you can find my work and the work that I do. It originally began as this way of bringing the principles of financial independence to the generosity world. So like all the things that we do and love here for people that listen to your podcast, I wanted to bring it to generous people who are either donating meaningful sums of money a year, or they were like, say, switching to high impact careers that were going to pay less or required something different of them that they needed support in that. lately I've been on a bigger push to bring some of these principles of how I think that we in the personal finance world can do good together. And so I recently launched something called the Philanthropy Pledge, which is a giving pledge for the personal finance community, where there are many, many people, there are 10,000 people all over the world who have taken things like a giving pledge already that give 1% of their income to charity, that give 2%, 3%, and some up to 10%, and some more. My hope is to instill some of these principles in the FIRE world and to create a really wonderful community of generous people to come together, to reward them, to give them resources. You know, I have always said that I think we're in the second phase of FIRE. The first phase was invest aggressively, save as much as you possibly can, early retire as fast as you can. I think we're in this phase now, which is really more inward looking, which is how to use money as a tool for living a meaningful life. And that could look very different for different people. As millions and millions of people get more involved in this movement, right? You know, like we know how much bigger this thing is than it was 10 years ago. I think this third phase could be like, what are we doing with our legacy? And I think that looks like a lot of different things, but I would like one of those things to be generosity. And I'm kind of taking a chance at being the voice for that and bringing people together, because we could live off the 4% rule and we could potentially be the 1% chance that our portfolio fails and we have no money, or we could be the 50% chance that we end up dying with lots and lots of money in our portfolios. And so I think we have a lot to give. And I think a call to action for the FIRE community is incredibly important, in addition to just sharing knowledge and sharing information, really, really a call to action to make something, to make a difference.
And if people want to learn more, they should head to the website.
Yep, yieldandspread.org. Perfect. And you can also, if you want to learn a little bit more about it, if you're a podcast listener, I did an episode with Brad on Choose FI about 2 years ago. If you just give a search for Choose FI Rebecca Herbst, Effective Giving, you can really get a download on more about Yield and Spread and what I'm trying to do there.
Perfect. All right. We'll link up that stuff in the show notes so it's easy for people to find. And Rebecca, super fun. We covered a lot of things. So I appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks, Doug, for having me on.